For the main message today, it's going to be kind of a history lesson, if you will, in some respects. And I'd like to kind of go through the Passover from vision to reality and lost and found throughout history. We had done something like this in similar respect last season during the readings. But I think it would be helpful for us to really consider the Passover and how it came into existence, how it has been kept and lost and then kept. Also, of course, reflecting on the ultimate fulfillment of the Passover. And so in the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And as these two beings who were and are God lived and worked together, there was conceived a vision that as God desired to expand his family, he wanted to have more people or beings like himself. And he pictured a universe, an existence with God-like beings that would live and that would work together in harmony and for the good of one another, out of a concern for one another, out of love, if you will, a kingdom of God that was built upon love. And so to accomplish this, he desired to have children. And these children would become his friends. And they would share in his vision of the kingdom of God. They would share in his ethical perspective. And these would be immoral people who would conduct themselves based out of concern for others. And so this vision then turned into a plan. And God decided that he would, in fact, recreate himself. And he would do so by using a physical means of existence. And a corporeal world was then created. And a universe were made. And they would be a training ground for these future sons and daughters of God. And in this physical existence, these people would learn right from wrong. Then they would do so by having the ability to make their own choices in life. And they would therefore come to see the results of choosing a way that was contrary to God. And they would come to understand how choosing what is right, that is doing, living the way God desired for them to live, would produce enormous peace and happiness and joy. However, God did understand that these people would not make it alone. These people would make mistakes. They would mess up. They would sin. And these people would need a Savior that would reconcile them back to himself. He knew that they would eventually choose the wrong way and they would have to be cleansed from their sin. And this would have to occur before they could be born again as righteous and holy spirit beings. Let's go over to 1 Peter in chapter 1. God also understood that the only way for this to occur is if he, very God, would become one of them. And then he would die as a worthy sacrifice for the sins of these future children. And for this reason, it was predetermined that the Word would become the Son of Man as the Son of God, the Lamb that was destined to be slain from the foundation of the world. In 1 Peter in chapter 1 and verse 18, it says, "Knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb, without blemish and without spot, he indeed was foreordained before the foundation of the world." Therefore we see, brethren, that the Passover was a part of God's vision before the universe even existed. And therefore God planned his vision. He knew what would have to occur. He knew that he would die for us. And he carried it out. Let's go over to Genesis, all the way back to Genesis in chapter 1. And so in the beginning of this plan, God created the heavens and the earth, and God allowed angels to rule over the earth. And he gave these angels freedom of choice, and many of them turned to selfishness, to wickedness, and they created havoc on the earth. And God was then forced to subdue these wicked angels, and a battle took place. And scars were left on the planet Earth, and it became without form and void of life. And scars even from this battle exist, actually, to this very day on the Earth. And we can see the scars from this battle on our moon and even throughout the solar system. And so God's plan after this came to the next phase with the creation of the world as we know it. Light shined on the face of the deep. Flora and fauna were created, and humankind were brought into existence. And God's way of life was shown to humankind, and his plan became then a destiny for the human race. Now, during this instruction process to the first people, the first man and woman, they were shown how to live, and they were also shown what days to observe. And God therefore set the stars in their respective places as an astronomical calendar so that these people and future generations could keep track of holy day observances. And we see this in verse 14 of chapter 1. And God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years." Stars, the word signs, meaning oath, a mark, a beacon, God's Sabbaths. Seasons, also the word moed, meaning festivals, and holy days. And so in order for humankind to begin to understand the scope of God's plan for mankind, their transcendent destiny, if you will, humans would be required to observe certain annual holy days. And these holy days actually picture God's purpose for humankind. And one of the most important of these holy days is the Passover. And God instructed the first humans to keep these days. And this is evident if you go over to Genesis in chapter 4. It's evident by reviewing verses 1 through 4. Genesis 4, where it says, "And Adam knew his wife, Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, 'I have acquired a man from the Eternal.' And then she bore again, this time, his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Eternal. And Abel also brought the firstborn of his flock, of their fat. And the Eternal respected Abel and his offering." And so by these words, these four verses, we understand that Cain and Abel were observing something here. What is it were they observing? Well, I suggest the evidence points to they were observing the Feast of Weeks. It says in the process of time they had brought these offerings. And this is a Hebrew expression that means at the end of days. And many Bibles even have a marginal note. Yours might have one. It says right there, at the end of days. Literally, that's what it means. And so what process concerning time has an end of days? Well, it's the process of counting that comes to an end. And here we have counting to the end of 50. Because in order to count to the end of something, there has to be a beginning, right? And where does that beginning fall? Well, that beginning falls the day after the Sabbath, between the days of unleavened bread, doesn't it? It follows the Passover. And so we see that Cain and Abel, they had brought a first fruit offering, a first harvest offering, if you will. And these were and are only brought and presented to God during the Feast of Weeks. And so we see that these men, and at least some of their kin and their posterity, observed Pentecost. And therefore, to count to Pentecost, they must have had to observe Passover. And so we also see, as further evidence, Noah was referred to as a preacher of righteousness. And only those who keep God's commandments, that keep his statutes and his holy days, can hold such status as being a man who is righteous. And therefore, Noah and his family must have kept the Passover. If we go over to Genesis chapter 14, after the flood destroyed all but Noah and his family, the Passover continued to be kept by the faithful. It was likely passed down through the line of Shem, but somehow it became lost until God called a man known as Abram. And then God came to Abram and he spoke directly to him. And in verse 18 through 20 of chapter 14, we see here, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine, and he was the priest of the God the Most High. King of Salem means king of peace, by the way. And he blessed Abram and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And then Abram gave him tithe of all. Now this bread, it's been proven, and if you haven't read the booklet written by Mr. Armstrong, Who is Melchizedek, I suggest you do. It's proven Melchizedek was Christ. It is Christ. He is Christ, the King of Peace. He's the only one that has this title. And this bread and wine that was brought to Abram is interesting. It's likely that this was brought for a Passover observance. And as the new symbols were later added in the New Testament, it's likely that these symbols actually had already existed in the mind of Christ, that he knew these were going to be symbols of the New Testament Passover. And so could it be that Christ actually presented them here to Abraham in anticipation of that before his Last Supper with the disciples? In any case, Abram's name was eventually changed to Abraham, and he became moved on to become known as a father of the faithful, a patriarch from whom many generations would be blessed because of his commitment to God. If you go over to chapter 26 of Genesis, chapter 26 and verse 4, "And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." Well, actually, this is God speaking to Isaac, but it's a reference to the blessing coming to his posterity because of Abraham's commitment to God. It's obvious that Abraham and his family kept the commandments. They kept the holy days, the statutes, and judgments. In fact, this word here, my statutes, is a Hebrew term that means appointed customs and ordinances. In relation to this, although we cannot dogmatically say it, the very day that Abraham was instructed to offer Isaac as a sacrifice was likely the Passover. Think of the symbolism involved. Let's go back there, Genesis 22. Chapter 22. Consider the symbolism, Abraham being a type of godlike figure and Isaac being a type of Christ the Son being offered. In Genesis 22, in verses 6 through 8, "So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, 'My father.' And he said, 'Here I am, son.' And then he said, 'Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?' And Abraham said, 'My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering.' And so the two of them went off together." And so it's interesting here. Think about it. It's interesting that Isaac said, "Where's the lamb for a sacrifice?" And Abraham said, "Well, God is going to provide a lamb." Why a lamb? Of all the clean animals that they could have offered to God, why did both of them think that it should be a lamb on this particular day? You know, could it be that they, in fact, were used to sacrificing a lamb at this time of year because it was the Passover? I think it's very possible. Isaac didn't resist Abraham when he realized what was taking place, and they Both of these individuals actually sought to do God's will, no matter what that was. And so we see how the faith of Abraham was passed to Isaac. It was passed to Jacob. It was passed to Joseph and to many of Joseph's brothers to some degree. And if we go over to Exodus 12 now, during Israel's residence in Egypt, the 12 tribes grew to an enormous number there. As decades and then centuries had passed, the Passover was eventually lost once again to Israel. And eventually they had forsook God in this land, and they didn't keep his commandments. And therefore God had allowed them to become slaves to the Egyptians. And although God allowed this, he did not forsake Israel. He did not completely leave them. He saw their oppression. He heard their cries of anguish and sorrow, and he did deliver them from the Egyptian taskmasters. Upon so doing, God had to reintroduce the Passover to his people, and he would do so in a dramatic way that would add an even richer, a deeper, and a more profound meaning to what the Passover foreshadowed. Let's look at this. In Exodus 12, beginning to verse 1. In verse 1, "Now the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, 'This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, On the 10th day of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons, according to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. And your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats.'" And this, of course, reminds us, I believe, of 1 Peter 1:18 that states, "Knowing you are not redeemed with corruptible things from silver and gold, which we have read already, but with the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish and without spot." In verse 6, "Now you shall keep this lamb until the 14th day of the same month, and then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight." And this is a word, twilight, meaning dusk or after sunset. So the lamb was to be kept a full 4 days, 24-hour days, not partial days. And of course, this, I believe, because of the four-day symbolism, we see that later in Mark 11 shows us how Christ entered Jerusalem on the riding a donkey 4 days prior to his crucifixion. Continuing in verse 7, "And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat." Romans 5:9 is a parallel scripture here. "Much more, having been justified by Christ's blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him." And this is how these people were saved, from the blood of the lamb being on their house, as a mark, if you will. "And then they shall eat the flesh of this lamb that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it." This reminds us of Christ taking the bread, blessing it and breaking it and giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take and eat, this is my body." Verse 10, "You shall let none of it remain until the morning, and what remains of it until the morning you shall burn with fire." Morning meaning boker, meaning dawn, when the sun is starting to come up. "And thus you shall eat it, with a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover." And this was symbolic, of course, of the people being ready to leave. Take the Passover, but be ready to leave Egypt. Be ready to leave this life of sin. And this symbolizes us, of course, before we take the Passover, being prepared to leave a life of sin. Count the cost, right? Before baptism, we count the cost. Are you ready to do it? Make ourselves ready for it. Verse 12, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Eternal. And now the blood of the lamb shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt." And I believe a parallel scripture for this is 1 John 1:7, which states, "But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Christ cleanses us from all sin, so that we will not have to suffer the death sentence that sin requires." Continuing in verse 14, "So this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it a feast to the Eternal throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance." Here's the feast. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. This, believe, I have a parallel scripture for this, if you want to put it in your Bible. 1 Corinthians 5, 7 through 8, where Paul tells us to purge out the old leaven, that we may be a new lump, since you are truly unleavened, because Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. And so let us keep this feast, not with the old leaven of malice and wickedness, but the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And this is what we are required to do. And the person who does not eat or who eats leavened bread during these days knowingly is cut off. This shows that it's a strict ordinance. God is quite serious about this, about what is to be done during this feast. On the first day, in verse 16, there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, except that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared by you. So you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt, and therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at evening, after sunset, in other words, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. This is referring to the 15th. After sunset, after the 14th has passed, 7 days. For 7 days, no leaven shall be found in your houses. Since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. Seven, of course, I think, as we all are aware, seven being the number of completion, is, of course, symbolic here as well. So we are given 7 days to not have sin in our lives, as far as symbolized by the leaven. And I believe this symbolizes a complete amount of time that God is giving us in this life to remove sin from our lives. We're given sufficient time to do so in order to prepare ourselves for Christ's return. In verse 20, you shall eat nothing leavened in all your dwellings. You shall eat only unleavened bread. And then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, pick out and take lambs for yourselves according to your families and kill the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until the morning. They didn't go out until the morning. Again, the word boker, meaning dawn, when the sun is coming up. They didn't head out at midnight, as some believe. Verse 23, for the Eternal will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Eternal will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you. And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. It will come to pass, when you come to the land which the Eternal will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep the service. And it shall be, when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? That you will say, it is the Passover sacrifice of the Eternal, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households. So the people bowed with their heads and worshipped. And then the children went out and did so, just as the Eternal had commanded. Just as Moses told them, that's what they did. Now the story, as we know, goes on to tell about the death of the firstborn. And this is actually what caused, out of all the plagues that Egypt had suffered, this is the one that caused Pharaoh to set the captives free. And I believe this, of course, foreshadowed the death of God's firstborn, being the only thing that can set us free from the bondage of sin's death sentence. Without it, you and I would be destined to die. And so this ordinance was kept and was to be kept for all future generations. And you don't have to turn there, but chapter 10, verse 2 states that God did all of these things so that you may tell in the hearing of your son and in your son's son the mighty things that he has done in Egypt and his signs which he had done among them, that you may know that he is the Eternal. And then in Exodus 13, God further instructed Israel how they were to keep these days. And in verse 3, "And Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. For by strength of hand the Eternal brought you out of this place." And I believe this reminds us of Revelation 18:4, which says to come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and then receive of her plagues. No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you are going out in the month of Abib. And it shall be when the Eternal brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. In 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Eternal. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all of your quarters. And so here we have the de-leavening that we've all been doing to our homes over the last week. "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Eternal did for me when I came up from Egypt. This shall be a sign to you on your hand, and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Eternal's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Eternal has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. And it shall be when the Eternal brings you into the land of the Canaanites that he swore to you and your fathers and gives it to you, that you shall set apart to the Eternal all that open the womb, that is, every firstborn that comes from an animal which you have. The males shall be the Eternal's. But every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you will not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem," that is, redeem with a sacrifice, an animal sacrifice. "So it shall be when your son asks you in time, saying, what is this? That you will say to him, by strength of hand the Eternal brought us out of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Eternal killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. And therefore I sacrifice to the Eternal all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons and daughters, if you will, I will redeem." And this, of course, is referring to a sacrifice to redeem them. And I believe this also pictures the sacrifice of God's firstborn that redeems us. "And this shall be a sign," oath, "a mark on your hand and as frontlets between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Eternal brought us out of Egypt." And so this ordinance, like the Sabbath, like God's commandments and all of the annual holy days, the Passover is a mark of God's people. It's a sign upon our hands, meaning that which we put our strength to do. It's a mark on the frontlets between our eyes, referring to the frontal lobe here, where we process thought, where we ponder and consider and deeply think about what we are doing. Let's go over to Numbers in chapter 9. So important is this observance of the Passover that an issue came up the following year after Israel had come up out of Egypt, and certain men had found themselves unclean and therefore unable to keep the Passover. Numbers 9, and beginning in verse 4, "So Moses told the children of Israel that they should keep the Passover, and they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month at twilight in the wilderness of Sinai, according to all that the Eternal commanded Moses. So the children of Israel did. Now there were certain men who were defiled by a human corpse or a dead body, so that they could not keep the Passover on that day. And they came before Moses and Aaron that day. And those men said to him, we became defiled by a human corpse. Why are we kept from presenting the offering of the Eternal at its appointed time among the children of Israel?" And so these men were very concerned, and as well they should be, that they wanted to be right with God, and they understood the law of the unclean, those things that would consider them to be unclean, not unclean meats, but other ways that people would become unclean by touching a dead body or a dead animal, or coming into contact with people that were diseased, or even becoming sick or diseased themselves. And so they wanted to be right with God. They wanted to know how to make this right. And so they inquired to Moses. And Moses inquired to God. And here's what he said. Moses said to them, "Stand still," in verse 8, "that I may hear what the Eternal will command concerning you." And then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, if any one of you or your posterity is unclean because of a corpse, or is far away on a journey, he may still keep the Eternal's Passover. On the 14th day of the second month, at twilight, they may keep it, and they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs." And so important is the Passover to God's people that he allowed those that were unclean or happened to be in a distant area during its observance, that he allowed them to still keep it. He said, you have to keep it. You have to keep this day. And if for circumstance find yourself where you're unable to keep it, then I'm going to allow you to keep it exactly 1 month later. As he said in verse 11, continuing in verse 12, "They shall leave none of it until the morning, nor break one of its bones," referring to the lamb. "According to all the ordinances of the Passover, they shall keep it." And so all the symbols of the Passover were to remain the same. The only allowance was that if there was a legitimate reason that it could not be kept in the first month on the 14th, God would allow troubled individuals to keep it exactly 30 days later on the second month on the 14th. And no other holy days, actually, allow for something like this to occur. Not a single one. And I think this shows how important the Passover is to God and for us to keep it. And I believe this also shows us something else. It shows us that the Passover ceremony was a domestic observance and was not a ceremony that was performed by the priests for the people. And having the priests sacrifice the lambs for the people came at a later time. And whether or not God approved of this being done is a matter of debate, which we won't go into at this time. But we have to understand that the inclusion given to keep the Passover in the second month cannot be an excuse simply for sake of convenience. We can't reason that we're able to make plans and will somehow not be available to keep the Passover on the 14th of the first month. We can't plan a vacation or a fishing trip, or buy concert tickets, knowing that these days that's going to fall on the Passover, and thinking, well, it's okay, I can keep it a month later. That's not the case at all. It doesn't work that way. Numbers 9 and verse 13. "But the man who is clean and is not on a journey and ceases to keep the Passover, that same person shall be cut off from among his people, because he did not bring the offering of the Eternal at its appointed time. That man shall bear his sin." And so this ordinance applies to all who God has called and all who desire to do what is right. It stood for both the Israelites and the converts. And we can only excuse ourselves from keeping it the 14th of the first month if, we find ourselves in a circumstance where we're away from our families. In this case, when we're away from our families of faith. Or if we're ill, if we become very sick and we're unable to keep it. Verse 14, "If a stranger dwells among you and would keep the Eternal's Passover, he must do so according to the rite of the Passover and according to its ceremony. You shall have one ordinance for both the stranger and the native and the land." And so this stood, again, as I had stated, for both Israel and for those who would be converted to desiring to live God's way of life. The symbols of the ceremony would not change depending on race or depending on class. In like manner, the symbols of the New Testament ceremony do not change, do they? They cannot be misused. They cannot be taken outside of their designated days. Many religions out there, denominations of quote-unquote Christianity, will take the Passover every week. And this can't be done. God says you can't change it. You can't move it around for sake of your convenience or to fulfill something that you want to fulfill. They can't be changed for sake of preference, simply because we don't like unleavened bread. You know, we can't change the symbolism. It's not possible. In addition to this, there is an enduring principle to Numbers in chapter 9 for all of us. And it's this: we need to make ourselves clean. We need to do all we can to make ourselves ready to keep the Passover, to be as pure as we possibly can before taking it. And this is why self-examination is so strongly preached, both in the scriptures and by the churches of God out there during this time of year, that we need to be ready to prepare ourselves, to examine ourselves before the Passover, to be sure that we are not unclean, defiled in some way. As the scripture states, if somebody has something against us, we are to leave our gift at the altar and go and reconcile with our brother and then come back and offer our make our offering to God. In other words, get right with one another, you know, then come back to God and keep his holy days, right? If we don't try to make ourselves ready and we take the Passover and observe the days of unleavened bread, it can be likened to carrying an unclean thing before God. Can you imagine dragging a dead body to the Passover service? Well, it's kind of like that if we're not making ourselves ready, trying to clean ourselves up and get ready to take God's Passover. And so I ask us to get ready for it. You know, we still have some time left. There's a little more than 48 hours left before the, a little more than 24 hours left before the Passover ceremony. And we still have time to get right with God. We still have time to make a phone call if we want to call that person that we may have offended and tell them, you know, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry I hurt you, and I really want to make things right. And we can do this. We still can do this if we have not done so already. Allowing individuals who find themselves in straits to take the Passover 30 days later on the 14th of the second month, it's an act of God's mercy. We can't misuse it. And that is very important for us to realize. Let's go now over to Joshua in chapter 5. After the command to keep the Passover no matter what, and the allowance to take it 30 days later if necessary, Israel had proceeded to wander in the wilderness that's called sin for 40 years. And during this period of time, though the people were not always faithful in every respect, they did faithfully keep the Passover during this time. Every year they kept the Passover. And finally, when Israel was set to enter the Promised Land, they began their mission by God miraculously drying up or assuaging the mighty Jordan River. And the people crossed over on dry land. And then after they made this journey across the dry riverbed, they encamped in Gilgal and they began to make themselves ready to keep the Passover. Joshua 5, in verses 1 through, we're going to read, probably read this entire chapter. So it was when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Eternal had dried up the waters in the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted. In other words, they were pretty nervous about this, fearful because of what had happened so far. And there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. They were afraid. And the time of the Eternal... And at that time, the Eternal said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourself and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time. And so Joshua made flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the hill of the foreskins. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All people who came out of Egypt were males. All the men of war had died in the wilderness on the way. Remember, God said all these people would die. And their children would go into the Promised Land. They had died on the way after they had come out of Egypt, for all the people who came out had been circumcised. But all the people born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. And I think this is reflective of of them losing their way in some respect. And I don't think this reflects that they were not keeping the holy days, but they were not all circumcising their children. For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt were consumed, because they did not obey the voice of the Eternal, to whom the Eternal swore that he would not show them the land which the Eternal had sworn to their fathers that he would give us, a land flowing of milk and honey. And then Joshua circumcised their sons, whom he raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. And so here we are, Israel, making themselves clean, getting ready to keep the Passover. So it was, when they had finished circumcising all the people, that they stayed in their places in the camp till they were healed. And then the Eternal said to Joshua, "This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." And therefore the name of this place is called Gilgal to this day. Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal, and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. And they ate the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. And then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. And this is interesting. Verse 13, "And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him." At least it looked like a man to him. "And Joshua went to him," "a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, 'Are you for us or for our adversaries?' And so he said, 'No. But as commander of the army of the Eternal, I have now come.' And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, 'What does my Lord say to his servant?' And then the commander of the Eternal's army said to Joshua, 'Take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy.' And Joshua did so." And I believe by this last statement in this chapter here, this shows that this was Christ that came to him. This was not just an angel. Because an angel would not allow someone to bow before them and worship. They would say, "I'm not God. Get up." But this one said, allowed him to bow and worship. And then he said the same words he said to Moses, "Take your shoe off your foot, for where you are standing is holy ground." And I believe this was done as an inspirational appearance for Joshua and for the people. Because Moses told Joshua that God would be with him. And I believe I think Joshua believed that. But can you imagine now God coming down and meeting with you and speaking to you directly like he spoke to Moses? This would be very inspiring for Joshua. Joshua would be motivated with great strength and courage to do exactly as God was going to request of Israel. And giving the telling of this event to the people after it occurred would have greatly inspired them as well. And so after this, Israel began to keep the days of unleavened bread outside of Jericho, as we had just read. But during this time, each day, a chosen number of individuals went out and they marched around the city of Jericho. And we had just read this in the Bible story with my daughters recently. And finally, on what was likely, I believe, the last day of unleavened bread, and I can't say for sure, but likely the last day of unleavened bread, they marched around the city seven times instead of a single time. And then they stopped, and seven priests blew seven shofars, and all of the army yelled, shouted, and the walls of Jericho came down. The Israelite armies proceeded to take the city and the land that God had promised to them, and they moved forth and settled in various areas of Canaan. But as we know, Israel did not remain faithful throughout their generations, did they? No, they did not. They did have years of prosperity when they obeyed God, but their faith waned, and therefore so did God's blessing. and his protection upon them. And if you go back to Deuteronomy 31, we can see that God knew these people. He knew their minds. He knew their nature. And he figured that this would happen. And therefore, he told Moses what he would do when it did. In chapter 31 of Deuteronomy, verse 16, the Eternal said to Moses, "Behold, you will rest with your fathers," meaning you're going to die, "and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land where they go to be among them. And they will forsake me, and they will break my covenant which I made with them. And then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, 'Have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us?' And I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they have done, and that they have turned to other gods. And now therefore write this down, this song, for yourselves, and teach it to the children of Israel, and put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel, when I have brought them to the land flowing with milk and honey, which I swore to their fathers, and have eaten and filled themselves and grown fat. Then they will turn to the other gods and serve them, and they will provoke me and break my covenant. And so it shall be, when many evils and troubles have come upon them, that this song will testify against them as a witness, for it will not be forgotten in their mouths, descendants. For I know the inclination of their behavior, even before have I brought them to the land which I swore to give them." And so Moses proceeded to write this song after some more words that God spoke to him. But in any case, God knew the nature of these people. And though he chose them to be a holy nation, it was not because they were righteous. It was not because they were somehow prominent in some way. It wasn't because of themselves that God chose to bring them out of bondage and to create them a nation of kings and priests as they were to be. As he had earlier told them, and you don't have to go there, in chapter 7 of Deuteronomy in verse 6, "You are a holy people to the Eternal your God. The Eternal your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure, yes, above all peoples on the face of the earth. But the Lord did not set his love on you or choose you because you were more in number than any people. You weren't greater than anybody else. That's not the reason. For you were the least of the peoples," he said. "But because the Eternal loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, that the Eternal has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage and from Egypt." And so these people were the weakest, if you will, of all nations. And though God continually encouraged them to do what is right, and some did remain faithful to God, their faith waxed and waned and waxed and waned for more than 450 years during the time of the judges. And then it moved into the time of the kings, and their faith continued to wax and wane. Throughout these many centuries, the vast majority turned to Baal. They turned to idol worship, and God's law was forgotten, and the Passover became lost to Israel. Think about it. King Saul was evil in many respects, but still God's way was practiced by many under his rule. And then we have King David, who did right in the eyes of God. But after King David's death, Solomon did right for some time, didn't he? But in his latter days, he allowed and even encouraged Israel to worship false gods. And then we have a long list of evil kings down through the age of Israel, and also a people that clung to lawless behavior. Wicked kings such as King Jeroboam, Rehoboam, Nadab, Abiliam, Baasha, Lela, Zimri, Omri, and then finally, King Asa, a righteous king who did right in the eyes of God. But then after his reign, we have Jehoshaphat, a wicked king, Ahab, Ahaziah, Jehoram, Athaliah, Jehu, Jehoahaz, Joash, and then finally a different Joash who did right, but sadly only in his youth, and he also turned to wickedness. And then following him, King Amaziah, who did right initially again, but then in the latter days he turned to evil as well. Then we have the wicked kings of Zechariah and Shalem, Menahem, Pekahiah, Pekah, and then finally another righteous king, King Uzziah, also known as Azariah, who was good in the sight of God. He admonished Judah to follow God and turned them back to keeping the commandments and also to keeping the Passover. And he was succeeded by King Jotham, who was also a good man, who feared God and taught and enforced God's law. But then we have Ahaz arose as king in Judah, and he did evil in the sight of God, and the Passover was again lost. Let's go over to 2 Chronicles and chapter 29, 2 Chronicles 29. And then, again, finally, King Hezekiah restored God's law in Judah and reinstated the Passover. And we have the account of this in 2 Chronicles in chapter 29. Hezekiah became king when he was 25 years old, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did what was right in the sight of God, according to all that his father David had done. In the first year of his reign, in the first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Eternal and repaired them, talking about the temple here. And then he brought in the priests and the Levites, and he gathered them in the east square, and he said to them, "Hear me, Levites, sanctify yourselves, make yourselves clean, sanctify the house of the eternal God of your fathers, and carry out the rubbish from this holy place." Talking about items that were dragged in by previous wicked kings that defiled the temple. Verse 6, "For our fathers have trespassed and done evil in the eyes of the eternal our God. They have forsaken him and have turned their faces away from the dwelling place of the Eternal and turned their backs on him. They have also shut up the doors of the vestibule and put out the lamps and have not burned incense or offered burnt offerings in the holy place to the God of Israel. And this is why the wrath of the Eternal fell upon Judah and Jerusalem. And he has given them up to trouble, to desolation, and to jeering, as you see for yourself with your own eyes. For indeed, because of this, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons, our daughters, and our wives are in captivity. And now it is in my heart to make a covenant with the eternal God of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us. My sons, do not be negligent now, for the eternal has chosen you to stand before him, to serve him, and that you should minister to him, and to burn incense." And so these Levites arose, and it goes through names of a bunch of the Levites, many of which I would have a hard time pronouncing. And verse 15, "They gathered their brethren and sanctified themselves and went according to the commandment of the king of the words of the Eternal to cleanse the house of the Eternal. And the priests went into the inner part of the house of the Eternal to cleanse it. And they brought out all the debris that they found in the temple of the Eternal to the court of the house of the Eternal. And the Levites took it out and carried it to the brook Kidron. And so they began to sanctify on the first day of the first month." Note the time. The first day of the first month. "And on the eighth day of the month, they came to the vestibule of the Eternal. And so they sanctified the house of the Eternal in 8 days. And on the 16th day of the first month, they were finished." So it took actually 16 days to finish the cleansing of this. And they missed the Passover. And then they went into King Hezekiah and said, "We have cleansed all the house of the Eternal and the altar of the burnt offerings with all its articles and the table of the showbread with all its articles. And moreover, all the articles which King Ahaz in his reign had cast aside in his transgression, we have prepared and sanctified. And there they are before the altar of the Eternal." And so King Hezekiah rose early and gathered the rulers of the city and went up to the house of the Eternal. And they brought seven rams and seven male goats for a sin offering. And they proceeded to make all of these offerings to God. And In verse 25, he stationed the Levites in the house of the Eternal with cymbals and with strings and instruments and harps, according to the commandment of David and Gad of kings. And he was restoring worship here, true worship of the true God here in the temple. And Hezekiah commanded in verse 27 them to offer the burnt offering on the altar. And when the burnt offering began, the song of the Eternal also began with the trumpets and with its instruments of David, king of Israel. So all the assembly worshipped, and the singers sang, and the trumpeters sounded. And all this continued until the burnt offering was finished. And you can imagine how glorious this would have been, and how much this would have pleased God to see a people desiring to do what is right, cleansing the temple, cleansing themselves, praising him with word and song and with sacrifice, a sweet savor to the Eternal. And when they were finished offering, the king and all who were present with him bowed and worshipped. And moreover, King Hezekiah and the leaders commanded the Levites to sing and praise the Eternal with the words of David and of Asaph the seer. And so they sang praises with gladness and bowed their heads and worshipped. And then Hezekiah answered and said, "Now that you have consecrated yourselves to the Eternal, come near and bring sacrifices and thank offerings into the house of the Eternal." So the assembly brought in the sacrifices and offerings, and many were brought in. People with a willing heart brought burnt offerings. And the number of the burnt offerings which they had brought was 70 bulls and 100 lambs and 100 rams and 200 lambs, all for a burnt offering. And they consecrated all of these things. Verse 34, "But the priests were too few, so that they could not skin all the burnt offerings. And so their brethren, the Levites, helped them until the work was ended, and until the other priests had sanctified themselves. For the Levites were more diligent in sanctifying themselves than the priests." In verse 36, "Then Hezekiah and all the people rejoiced, and God had prepared the people since the events took place so suddenly." And we see that Hezekiah wanted to restore God's way, but God's way had been lost in many respects, and so he didn't know how to do everything right. I think all that they did here was all right, but something was missing. Something had been forgotten. Something had been lost. The Passover. In chapter 30, Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah and also wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to the Eternal God of Israel. For the king and his leaders and all the assembly in Jerusalem had agreed to keep the Passover in the second month. And so we see that God gave them the inclusion, right? They were unclean. The temple was unclean. They hadn't finished making themselves clean and pure before the Passover on the 14th of the first month. And God would allow them to keep it the second month, the 14th of the second month. "For they could not keep it at the regular time because a sufficient number of priests had not consecrated themselves, nor had the people gathered together at Jerusalem. And the matter pleased the king and all the assembly. And so they resolved to make a proclamation throughout all Israel, from Beersheba to Dan, that they should come to keep the Passover to the Eternal God of Israel at Jerusalem. For since they had not done it for a long time in the prescribed manner." And so here we have King Hezekiah not only reinstating the Passover, but he's reaching out to his brethren, reaching out to the other tribes, a nation that was divided, reaching out saying, "Come, let's come together. Let's keep the Passover. Let's be one with one another." Just as we should be reaching out to our brethren. And so runners went throughout all the Israel and Judah where the letters from the king and his leaders spoke according to the commandment of the king. Children of Israel, return to the Eternal God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, and then he will return to the remnant of you who have escaped from the hand of the kings of Assyria. And do not be like your fathers and your brethren who trespassed against the Eternal God of their fathers, so that he gave them up to a desolation. Do not be stiff-necked as your fathers were, but yield yourselves to the Eternal and enter his sanctuary, which he has sanctified forever. And serve the Eternal your God. The runners passed from city to city, and they were being mocked by these other tribes. And nevertheless, some of Asher and Manasseh and Zebulun humbled themselves, and they came to Jerusalem. And also the hand of God was on Judah to give them singleness of heart to obey the command of the king and the leaders at the word of the Eternal. Now many people of a great assembly gathered at Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread in the second month. When they arose and they took away the altars that were in Jerusalem, and they took away all the incense altars and cast them into the brook Kidron, and they slaughtered the Passover lambs on the 14th day of the second month, the priests and the Levites were ashamed and sanctified themselves and brought the burnt offerings to the house of the Eternal. And they stood in their place according to their custom, according to the law of Moses, the man of God. The priests sprinkled the blood and received from the hand of the Levites. And there were many, for there were many in the assembly who had not sanctified themselves, and therefore the Levites had charge of the slaughter of the Passover lambs for everyone who was not clean, to sanctify them to the Eternal. And so here we have, as I had mentioned earlier, a transference of the lambs being slaughtered domestically to now it's being done by the priests because the people were unclean. Now, again, whether God approved of this or not is debatable. It's likely that this was okay in his eyes because he wanted them to keep the Passover. And I think that God went ahead and sanctified what had taken place at this time. A multitude of the people from Ephraim and Manasseh and Issachar and Zebulun had not cleansed themselves, and yet they ate the Passover contrary to what was written. But Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, "May the good Eternal provide atonement for everyone who prepares his heart to seek God, the Eternal God of his fathers, though he is not cleansed." Let's jump down to verse 25. The whole assembly of Judah rejoiced, also the priests and the Levites and all the assembly that came from Israel, the sojourners who came from the land of Israel and those who dwelt in Judah. And there was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there had not been nothing like this in Jerusalem. You imagine, it must have been very moving. And then the priests and the Levites arose, and they blessed the people, and their voices heard, and their prayer came up to God's holy dwelling place, to heaven. And so Hezekiah had restored the Passover, he restored the temple, and he reigned for 29 years, and then had died of natural causes. Hezekiah brought hope once again to Judah and to Israel by enforcing God's way of life. However, after his death, King Manasseh came to rule, and he did evil, great evil, for 55 years in the land of Judah. Amon's reign was much shorter than that of his father, and yet he walked in the same wicked footsteps. And then Josiah came to rule, and his was a reflection of that of Hezekiah and Uzziah, and also Asa. He did right, and he wanted to obey God. Let's go over to 2 Kings in chapter 22. Josiah had a great zeal for God from his youth, and the maturity of his reign as a teenager was beyond his years. And such good was restored under his leadership that God allowed the land to be in peace all the days of Josiah's life. In chapter 22 of 2 Kings, in verse 3, it came to pass in the eighth year of King Josiah that the king sent Shaphan the scribe, the son of Azaliah, the son of Meshulam, to the house of the Eternal, saying, "Go to Hilkiah the priest, the high priest, that he may count the money which has been brought into the house of the Eternal, which the doorkeepers have gathered, and let them deliver it into the hand of those doing the work." And so this was done. And let's go ahead and jump down to verse 10. Then Shaphan the scribe showed the king, saying, "Hilkiah the priest has given me a book." And Shaphan read it before the king. And now it happened, when the king heard the words of the book of the law, that he tore his clothes. And the king commanded Hilkiah the priest of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, Achbor the son of Micaiah, Shaphan the scribe, and Asahiah, the servant of the king, saying, "Go of the Eternal, go inquire of the Eternal for me, for the people and for all of Judah, concerning the words of this book that has been found. For great is the wrath of the Eternal that is aroused against us, because our fathers have not obeyed the words of this book to do according to all that is written concerning us. And so the law of God was recorded by Moses, was found while restoring the sanctity of the temple. And though Josiah was moved by his passion for God, we see that many of the statutes and the judgments and the holy days were lost until a time again of restoration. And as the king had rediscovered these instructions and these truths, he was very concerned about the future of the nation, as well he should be. And so he sent the appointed priest and several others to inquire of God about what should be done. Now, interestingly, the servants went to a woman that was being taught in a house of instruction who apparently was considered to be very close to God. And their inquiry brought back word that God would actually destroy all of Judah. It was going to happen because of their wickedness in the past. However, there would be peace in the land for many years because of Josiah's passion. And this is shown to us in verses 19 and 20 of chapter 22. Because your heart was tender and you humbled yourself before the Eternal when you heard what I spoke against this place and against its inhabitants, that they would become a desolation and a curse, and you tore your clothes and wept before me, I also have heard you, says the Eternal. Surely, therefore, I will gather you to your fathers, and you shall be gathered to your grave in peace, and your eyes shall not see all the calamity which I will bring on this place. And so they brought back word, these words, to the king. Let's go to chapter 34 of 2 Chronicles. For more than 70 years, the Passover was lost. And finally, in the 18th year of Josiah's rule, not when he was 18 years old, but in the 18th year of Josiah's rule, the Torah is found, and it becomes clear exactly what must be done. Now, Josiah was very upset after reading what we know as the first four books of the Bible. And he wasn't disturbed at the understanding that he had gained from them, but his distress came by realizing what would become of a people that forsook God. And so he instructed everyone to tear down the idols. He instructed all of the false worship to be abolished in the land. He instructed them to proceed to keep the holy days and the Passover that had become lost by Judah during the previous era of lawlessness. In verse 30 of 2 Chronicles, chapter 34, the king went to the house of the Eternal with all the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the priests and the Levites, and all the people, great and small, and he read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant which had been found in the house of the Eternal. And the king stood in his place and made a covenant before the Eternal to follow the Eternal and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and to perform the words of the covenant that were written in the book. And he made all who were present in Jerusalem and Benjamin to take a stand. So the inhabitants of Jerusalem did according to the covenant of God, the God of their fathers. And so Josiah proceeded to remove all the abominations out of the country and instructed Israel to diligently serve the Eternal their God. All his days they did not depart from following the Eternal God of their fathers. 2 Kings 23. All the days of Josiah, he moved closer to restoring God's way in Judah. And a lot can happen in 50 years. And it took some time, therefore, to cleanse the land. Finally, the land was cleansed, and the people were ready, prepared to keep the Passover. In verse 21 of 2 Kings 23, then the king commanded all the people, saying, keep the Passover to the Eternal your God, as it is written in the book of this covenant. Such a Passover surely had never been held since the days of the judges who judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. But in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was held before the Eternal in Jerusalem. And Josiah put away those who consulted mediums and spiritists the household of gods and idols and all the abominations that were seen in the land of Judah and in Jerusalem, that he may perform the words of the law that were written in the book of Hilkiah. And there was no king like him. Before him, there was no king like him who turned to the Eternal with all his heart, with all his soul, and with all his might, according to the law of Moses. Nor after him did any arise that was like him. Ezra in chapter 6. Seeing that he was 8 years old when he was appointed king, Josiah reigned 31 years. And then Josiah died. And he died relatively young. He would have been only probably 39 or 40 years old. The Bible doesn't tell us exactly how his death occurred, but we do know that it was not a violent death. And it was because of his passion for God that he was promised peace all the days of his life. And he did have peace all of his days. However, after his death, Judah again fell to wickedness, and the Passover would again be lost to him. In the north, Hoshea, the last wicked king of the house of Israel before the Assyrian invasion, he turned against God. And this is all of Israel, the northern tribes, was conquered and taken captive. And they were eventually scattered to the winds of history. And today, even unto this day, the 10 tribes don't know who they are. In fact, the only tribe that really knows who they are is the tribe of Judah. The short reigns of Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah in Judah is comparable to the wicked leadership of King Manasseh. And though these kings were key players in the decline of Judah, they were not entirely to blame. The attitude and the behaviors of the people went right in line with iniquity. And this greatly influenced the rule of these wicked kings. And this is why Jerusalem fell and the temple was destroyed. And then, of course, we know the nation of Judah was taken captive to Babylon. And because of this, the Passover remained unobserved by the remaining tribes for nearly 80 years. And it wasn't reinstated until 70 years of captivity had passed. And at that time, there was a zealous few who had come back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And though the temple would be rebuilt inferior, they would rebuild it, and they would keep the Passover. I'm not going to read it. Ezra 6, verses 1 through 22 goes through this. But Ezra also had done something else. He changed the names of the months. He changed the language. And he centralized everything in the land at this time to try to keep people on the same page, to try to keep them on track with God. And he even had the people put away foreign wives that some were taking in the land. And the Passover was again found and was kept by God's people. However, the returning Jews, like their ancestors, waxed and waned and waxed and waned in their commitment to God and to his Passover. And even though it was kept, even up into Christ's ministry, it was not kept properly. It was not kept by people who were actually pure and clean. And the vast majority were unclean of the people who were keeping the Passover. Following the fulfillment of the Passover, when the Lamb of God, Christ, who is our Passover, was mocked, ridiculed, beaten, and then finally, mercilessly nailed to a stake, having his blood drained out for us, the New Testament church continued to keep the Passover, but they kept it with new symbols and a deeper meaning. And still, I think we've seen that it's possible anyway that these symbols were not new at all. These symbols had already existed in some respect in the mind of Christ when he appeared to Abraham. For the most part, though, the descendants of Israel unto this day, and this world has lost the Passover. In our age, even though there are some who keep the Passover today, it is a fraction of those who should be keeping the Passover. And among those who are keeping it, how many are doing so properly? I'm talking about the church, about us. How many people are actually making themselves clean and getting ready to keep the Passover in a way that God wants us to? Have we been working to make ourselves ready for it? Have we been examining ourselves? Are we even considering what an honor it is to be able to keep the Passover and the days of unleavened bread? You know, think about this. God has continually worked with people. We have a history book here of God working with people with extraordinary personalities, people that were building intimate relationships with him. They were the weak of the world, yes, but a people that were strong in faith, a people that had honor. Consider Noah and Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, Joseph, Joshua and Deborah, Moses. Consider David, and consider Hezekiah and Josiah, and consider Matthew and John and James. These are individuals that you and I see as champions of the faith. And yet somehow we find ourselves today falling within their ranks. Why? Do we see ourselves as a people that are being been called for the same purpose that these great men and women of faith have been called? As Mr. Quinn had said in one of his readings, who are we to keep company with such people? They were people with great zeal, people that had access to a lot less information than you and I have access to today. And yet somehow we have the same access that they had with God. As Mr. Barnes had said in his reading the book of Hebrews, we are surrounded with such a great cloud of witnesses. How then should we live, knowing that you and I are privileged to know the purpose of and privileged to keep the Passover and the days of unleavened bread? Do we actually grasp the honor of such a thing, something that we've been allowed to do? Or do we see ourselves as seeing them as just other days, something else that we need to check off on our checklist of things to do? Important, yes, but not realizing just how important they are. Have we somehow begun to minimize the Passover in this way by viewing them as simply a part of our duty, which they are our duty? Yes, they are, but not realizing that it is a great honor to be able to observe these days. In this last era of the church, before Christ's return, the Passover has been found by a relative few. One day it's going to be kept by all, and for sake of time, I'm not going to read it, but Ezekiel 45 goes through talking about how the Passover is going to be reestablished in the world as God's temple is going to be rebuilt. Untold numbers are going to be awakened to the truth of God and the observance of the Passover, and their eyes will be opened how Christ died for them as well as for us. And the knowledge of God is going to cover the earth at this time. Billions are going to come to understand the commandments. They're going to keep them and understand the Passover, things that you and I understand at this time. And so we find ourselves in a unique opportunity, and we cannot minimize it. We have been called by God to keep the Passover. And so I ask us to do so remembering exactly those people who have been given the same opportunity, those great men and women of faith who have kept the Passover faithfully. It's a great honor to find ourselves within their ranks. And it's our duty to keep the Passover, yes, but it's also our duty to make ourselves ready to keep the Passover. And so let's tear down those idols. Let's let go of that pride. Let go of the self. Let's live out of love for one another. Make a commitment to stop that sin that so easily besets us, and come to God tomorrow evening as one who is ready to keep the Passover.